Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, we have done another podcast similar to this one, but I don't think you can have too many conversations about the various generations that bookend America today. I'm talking about the baby boomer generation and then those younger people, let's say the millennials, the biggest, then the Gen Xers and so forth. And whether, in fact, we really are on the same page, because when you look at it, John, most of the benefit that the federal government puts out goes to older Americans.
This is true.
And I think a lot of younger people are saying, wait a minute, how come I'm saddled with all of this debt? How come I grew up in an era that nobody wants to recognize? I went through 9/11 as a young person. Then I went through the recession of 08-09. Now I'm going through this pandemic, and they are really being hard hit, the millennials, in terms of their forward movement in their careers. And we've got to look at our allocation of resource between and among the various generations. And by the way, I just want to remind people that when we did another podcast on this topic, I thought it was fascinating that this is the first time in history that six generations are alive at the same time.
That is a fascinating fact, and it's incredible. But I sometimes forget, because you're right, these kids came out of 9/11. And, you know, you forget that sometimes when you're talking to people. I'll say something about something, and they know nothing about it. It's like,
right. Well, their benchmarks and their milestones, if you say to them, well, one of the great moments in my life was watching the moonshot in 1969, right. And they look at you like, right. Or Camelot with JFK and all the possibilities.
Right.
And to them, that is ancient history.
Right. So they get it. You're absolutely right. I can see right off the bat, you know, you got to find some middle ground for talking to.
Well, and I don't understand, honestly, you know, why a lot of people think that this generation, John, and you've raised them and I have, are all such snowflakes. I hate when I hear that, because I think this is a great generation.
They are. They're and hardworking.
The problem I have when I have this conversation with Jill Filipovic is the fact that she was looking, perhaps, to get more resistance from me as a baby boomer about my perspectives and hers, but she found we were more in sync than she might think, because I really respect this generation of young people.
They're smart, you know, they're hardworking.
They're less prejudiced.
Right.
They're very open-minded. I think they're very urbane. They're very technologically savvy. I just think they're a great generation.
You know, but, you know, then you look at their problems. They're being held back because they went to school and got all this education. They're smart. It's hard to find jobs now, and they're saddled with all this debt. I mean, right off the bat,
and many of them are underemployed, unfortunately. Yeah, so. I mean, it's a really difficult time for them. So Jill wrote this book, Okay, Boomer, Let's Talk. So I took her up on it. The book, How My Generation Got Left Behind, that's the subtitle. And it's really a fascinating conversation that we have. And again, I wish there was more pushback from me, but I can't push back, because I agree with a lot of the perspectives of the millennials. And I just wish all the millennials well. And I really hope that they are really going to ascend into leadership positions even more quickly. Because when you look at the last election and two individuals in their 70s, that's not right. I mean, for the long term.
No,
it's their
right.
world.
That's
and
right.
you and I
you're
are.
Absolutely right.
Well, we're close to the exit, John. I see the exit.
No,
it's
you're
right
absolutely
there.
Right. I agree with you. I don't understand why we, there's a lot of bright young people out there, why we can't have more of them running for office and winning. And,
well, I do think we do. I mean, I do like a Pete Buttigieg and others. I do think they're there. And I also think that I've seen a lot of them as mayors when I've watched television programs on cable. And there they are talking about what their cities are doing during the pandemic. And I'm saying, wow, that mayor of Tucson or this or that.
Yeah,
I mean, they are upcoming. They
you
are.
Look at our house there, the Congress, who's in there and... These people got to go.
However,
they got to go.
You know, the last group that was elected in 2018, there's a lot of younger
people
younger in
people,
that
but they're
cohort.
They're still in control. They're still.
You mean the Senate, of course.
Yes, and the Senate. Oh,
where they're
God.
Walking around in circles, and they actually have somebody picking up the drool on
I
the
mean,
other
well,
side.
What do they know about technology? What do they know about Facebook? What do they know about...
Well, that is the funniest thing, John, when you see them interviewing Mark Zuckerberg and all these others, and they don't even know what they're talking about. They've got questions from their staff.
And something's got to be done, but they have no clue.
You know, you're absolutely
it's
right.
It's sad.
Well, let's get a clue right now. By the way, one thing I do want to say about this generation that is really interesting, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, but as we would answer a question, our generation, perhaps we say yes or thank you or whatever. I love what they say, which is perfect. Everything's perfect. And I am tempted to say, no, things aren't that perfect. Just because I gave you my right street address doesn't mean that's perfect. All right, let's move on, John.
Perfect.
On America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Jill Halipovich, and she's written a book called Okay, Boomer, Let's Talk. Well, you've got it, Jill. You've got a boomer on the line with you. But evidently, I think, represent a lot of folks in my generation. And frankly, I don't even understand what's happened in my generation, because we were so idealistic. We understood that there was public good in public activity at one time. We listened to people like Kennedy and Johnson and others who wanted to move things forward a bit. And all of a sudden, we're now this conservative generation that has taken the ladder that we were given, and I'm going to admit it. My first professional job, Jill, was afforded to me by virtue of the act that Jimmy Carter made possible, CETA, which is the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. And if it wasn't for that act, I never would have started my professional life the way I did, and it wouldn't have ended up perhaps as well as it did. So I don't understand why it is that we boomers really don't understand how difficult a position many of you millennials find yourselves in.
I think one thing that is not super well understood about baby boomers is that you really are the most politically polarized generation in America. So conservative, mostly white baby boomers have very much captured American politics. But you do have this whole other half of the generation that, as you said, you know, was optimistic and progressive, and were very much the foot soldiers, you know, in the feminist movement, in the movement against the war in Vietnam. And those boomers haven't gone away, nor have they necessarily gotten more conservative. They've just been outfoxed politically. You know, the good news, I think, is that those more progressive boomers have really won the hearts and the minds of the young and of the culture. So, yes, there have been tremendous political failures, the outcome of which millennials are now paying for. But I think it's at least a little bit heartening to understand that while, yes, conservative baby boomers and frankly some liberal baby boomers as well certainly hold responsibility for those political choices, there are a lot of boomers who do want to make the future better for their children and grandchildren.
Thank you for that. And that's so true. It really is. But you walked into a situation where America decided that individuality and individualism really needed to win the day, and that government really couldn't get anything done. And the way we treat public service, which is something that to me has really been an important part of life, serving even in public media as I did for so many years with PBS, and people dismiss it and make it lesser when we see civil servants and other, say, health officials in other countries who are venerated for their service to their community. In some way, America diminished all that and gave it all up to the private sector for the last 40 years. And so you fell into that period of time, and we also found that you were there at the point of 9/11, at the Great Recession of 2008, just as you're trying to get on your feet. And then, of course, this pandemic. And it's a remarkable set of circumstances that you've been handed.
Yes, it's a pretty blighted financial landscape for millennials. Now, as you said, we were born into an increasingly individualistic country. You know, the millennials started coming into the world in 1980, right, as Ronald Reagan was taking his presidency, and he was also the first president to be elected by the whole baby boom generation in 1984. And he really set about a pretty efficient program of dismantling so much of the great society that, you know, Lyndon Johnson had tried to build, so much of which had really given baby boomers a leg up into the middle class. Things like affordable and accessible higher education, things like expanded and higher quality healthcare, many of those gains were walked back for my generation. And part of the ethos, you know, was this kind of bootstrap narrative that I think a lot of baby boomers have frankly bought into about themselves. You know, that sort of invisible role of government has been further made invisible in hindsight, that boomers, I think, don't even fully realize the extent to which, you know, things like affordable housing and preferential mortgages for white families gave certain families in the U.S. a major leg up. I hear from boomers often, you know, how can you millennials complain that we've screwed things up for you? You know, I do so much for my millennial kids. I paid their college tuition. I still pay my 35-year-old son's cell phone bill. And that's true. You know, many, many boomers who had the resources did channel a tremendous amount of resources into their own children. But what really shifted is that while individual families did that, we didn't see that society-wide. And so as, you know, incomes and wealth became further stratified and wealth became further concentrated into a small number of hands, you had a really large number of people in my generation and those younger than me who had quite little and who didn't have the federal and state governments helping to give them a leg up the way that boomers had. And then, as you said, I graduated law school in 2008, and my first job at a law firm was the day that Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy. We entered the workforce into a Great Recession. So millennials, you know, were obviously the first on the chopping block if we were the newest employees to lose jobs. Many of us weren't able to get jobs for months or even years. And we've taken an earnings hit from which we still haven't recovered and are not likely to ever recover.
And now we're the hardest hit there. That is, America began to privatize in so many ways over the last 40 years. And folks, if you don't believe this, you can go back to podcasts that we've done, the Lewis Powell memo that the Republicans have used as their hymnal for the last 40 years. So there's great evidence of what has transpired during this period. But at the same time that that was happening, the private sector, which used to really provide for many of us, where somebody could work in an industrial setting and really support a family and ensure their future with a pension, all of that began to wither away. And then, of course, with automation coming online, and you guys really the first generation who really had to absorb all the technology, you're much more facile with it. But you, too, you know, had to grow with it. But with automation coming along and the lack of benefits and the companies outsourcing so much of their work, you entered into this gig economy at the same time. I don't understand And I had a real argument at a family gathering about a year ago, where I got the same pushback from another member of my generation saying, oh, that's just not true. They have it so good at this point. And I said, are you serious? The whole nature of work and the nature of our society has changed so dramatically.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of a pension kind of just makes me laugh. I have never met a person my age who has a pension, you know, and the idea that we're even going to have social security as we age, I think is a pretty outstanding question mark, right? So we certainly do not feel as though our employers will take care of us. You know, many millennials certainly don't have retirement accounts, aren't eligible to participate in their employee retirement programs. And even if we were, are so in debt from our student loans that we wouldn't have any money to put into it even if we were eligible.
But Jill, think about it. I'm talking about companies in the 60s and the late 50s and the 70s who really were investing. That was a good moment when you had unionized workforces. You had companies that were investing in the retirement for people, and you also had a growing safety net in America that hadn't been, to the degree that it could be, shredded or at least challenged at every turn throughout the last 30, 40 years.
Absolutely. And that's where I think, you know, I know obviously not all boomers, but where many boomers do just miss the challenges that millennials face. You know, if not for the remnants of that tattered social safety net, millennials would be the most impoverished generation since the Great Depression.
In your book, you do such a wonderful job with every chapter dealing with health and housing and work. You give us these bubbles with lots of information on just one page just to enforce or reinforce that which you are going to delve into in the course of the next chapter. But give us some of the statistics that really do prove your point.
So to me, one of the most striking is that millennials are now, we're the largest adult generation in America, we're 22% of the U.S. population, and yet we only hold 3% of the wealth. And when you contrast that, and of course, you would expect younger folks to hold less wealth than older folks, right? But millennials are now between the ages of 24 and 40. And when you contrast what boomers had when they were on average 35, boomers were something like 30% of the population, and they held 21% of American wealth. So you have seen this huge decline. And in that same period of time, U.S. GDP has grown and productivity has grown. So we now, adults in America, now work almost an extra month every year compared to how much Americans were working when boomers were young adults. So millennials are working more. We are working harder. We are much more educated than boomers were. We're the most educated adults in American history. The American economy has grown. And yet none of that is winding up, or very little of that is winding up in millennials' pockets. So there's something fundamentally broken here. And you know, I watch folks in my generation, you know, work and struggle and buy into this narrative that if I just work harder, if I just take a second gig, you know, if I just add some freelance work to my already full-time job, then maybe, you know, I'll get ahead, then maybe I'll have this stable life that, you know, I thought I would have by now. And really, it's not a problem of individual failing. It really is a political problem and a broad social problem.
I'm going to say this, that when I read, and of course you talk about this syndrome of the snowflake millennials, I don't get that. I mean, I've got millennials. I've got two of my own, and they have their own mates. And I'll tell you, they all work so hard. And I saw it recently when my daughter and her fiance stayed with us for 3 weeks. And just seeing how they are so disciplined and they are so passionate about their work and committed to what it is that they're doing. And yet, as you say, they're not seeing the economic benefits that did flow to at least my generation. Now, maybe you and I are overlooking the fact that, you know, the baby boom generation had it really good. We were in the midst of a lot of growth and development in American society, building the middle class after World War II. But, you know, previous generations, I mean, they didn't have a lot when it comes to material things, clearly. You know, the fact is we assume that every generation is going to do better than the previous generation. And I think the only way you're going to do that is by hoping that, well, you want us to live long and healthy lives, but that you're going to inherit the money that we're going to be leaving behind. I mean, that's, to me, the best case scenario right now.
Right. I mean, boomers are set to initiate the greatest wealth transfer in American history as they pass on their assets to their children. That said, that's going to benefit white millennials, but our generation is only 56% white, and Gen Z is obviously less white than we are. And that racial diversity is very much connected to the challenges that millennials face. You know, when you set up a system in your country of really intentionally giving white families a leg up while pushing down black and brown families, you see the results of that playing out in now a racially diverse generation of young people. You know, black millennials are less likely to own their homes than black Americans, black young adults were in the civil rights movement in the 60s. That's stunning.
You know, it's really interesting, Jill, that you bring this up, because I just recorded a podcast and I had never really framed it in this way before. But if you look at it, after the Civil War, when African Americans were freed, if you will, and then recommitted to a certain indentured status through Jim Crow for 100 years, then the civil rights movement, which was aborted in many ways by those attempting pushback, saying we were going too fast, we're going too fast. And then ultimately Barack Obama coming on the scene and people thinking that was a real sea change, followed by Donald Trump's administration. At every turn, African Americans have been told it's coming, it's here, it's almost here, and it never quite gets here. Do millennials feel the same way?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, as I said, millennials were an incredibly racially diverse generation. We are the most racially diverse adults in America. And so that means that so many of the statistics that you read or see about our generation are reflective of that long history of American racism. So, for example, millennials are now the most incarcerated people in the United States. We make up about half, a little more than half of all U.S. prisoners. We were the most incarcerated children in the United States. At the point at which juvenile detention hit its peak, everyone under the age of 18 was a millennial. Millennials also grew up in a time, you know, in the 1980s and 90s where mass incarceration was scaling up, which means that a lot of us had the trauma of having a parent behind bars and having a parent ripped away from our households. So you can't separate that from the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and American racism. And of course, that all feeds in to now a dynamic where millennials are struggling, where we're poorer, and where we have far less wealth than generations before us.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Jill Filipovich is with us. The book is called Okay, Boomer, Let's Talk, How My Generation Got Left Behind. How did some of the tropes come about? Because, again, as I say, my experience with millennials is anything but that which you do repeat in the book, just to break it down and tear it apart. For example, jobs. We are hearing, well, they move around a lot. They have no loyalty. They don't like feedback. They really have to be passionate or they don't want to do the work. You remind us that you're working so hard, oftentimes at many different separate jobs just to, earn the money that you need to pay the rent, which increasingly is part of what your daily budget is all about, much more so even than my generation. And you say, we're just working hard just to tread water.
Absolutely. And I think there are a couple of things that happen with the stereotypes around millennials. One is just the same as it ever was, older folks deciding that the kids are doing it wrong. And that's been true forever, right? When boomers were young, they were these, you know, entitled narcissists. There was that famous Tom Wolfe essay in New York Magazine called The Me Generation, which was about baby boomers. You know, before that, the older folks were concerned about, you know, the beatniks. And there's always the kids.
Yeah, and we overtly went to war with anybody over 30, at least in our minds and in our music and in our cultural persuasion. And yet somehow we really morphed into them, moved right into homes that they couldn't even afford, the previous generation, in a suburbia that was more exclusionary than ever before.
Exactly. So, you know, some of this stuff is just cyclical and, you know, is as it always goes, tensions between the old and the young. But I think what is a little bit different now is that there is this sort of political and media outrage machine, I think led by Fox News and right-wing media, that really intentionally stokes boomer resentment of the young. So, you know, I include some of the Fox segments in the book, but, you know, it's things like, most millennials are intimidated by plants, you know, and a majority of
are
millennials.
What was that?
This is a real Fox segment about how most millennials are intimidated by plants.
By plants.
It's completely absurd. But the message really is, you know, millennials are overly sensitive and they're coming for you. They're coming for the American way of life. When in reality, of course, millennials are going to have slightly different values than their parents. I mean, that was obviously true of baby boomers as well compared to their parents. And I think what a lot of boomers miss is that, you know, we were raised generally to be pretty decent people, to be empathetic, to be compassionate.
Well, you were raised by us.
And we were raised by boomers, exactly, raised by boomers to treat people kindly. You know, and now when Fox kind of laughs at, oh, you all got participation trophies, which is why you're so entitled, you know, I think you sort of flip that and you say, well, you know, as parents, didn't you want to raise a generation of kids with high self-esteem and who were fundamentally decent? And so now you have a generation of adults who do want to do work that feels meaningful, who do overwhelmingly say that they would take a pay cut to work at a company whose mission they believed in, that they believed was doing something positive for the world, who do want to treat other people with respect. And yes, that might mean using that person's chosen pronoun. To see that flipped around as you guys are these overly PC, you know, snowflake scolds, to me it's like, well, no, we're just a generation of decent human beings, and you guys raised us this way.
Yeah, I know. It's so interesting. By the way, there was one thing that you said in the book, and everything is pretty clear-cut in the book, and I really recommend that boomers and others get it, because there's a lot of defining characteristics about our generation and their generation that I think we all need to understand. But you said something that I really would love for you to expand upon. You said the difference with parents is partly economics, policy, and opportunity, and partly about values. Not ones you hold, but in values we live. Explain that.
So one thing that I do think is definitional to the general millennial experience is that we were a generation that was told, follow your dreams, follow your passion. I think boomers, of course, you know, there were some boomers who were raised with that message, but I think overwhelmingly boomers had more of a sense of, you know, you follow, even if in your teens and 20s, you were part of the counterculture. By the time boomers hit their, you know, late 20s, early 30s, most of them were married. Most of them had settled down. And, you know, I think about my own parents, and they both love their jobs, but the idea that you would follow a career path because it inspired you rather than because it was a good career was just not really something that was on the table. And I think as boomers found, as so many boomers found, that, you know, middle-class stability, they really wanted their kids to level up, to have the ability to think about, well, what do I want to be? What do I want my life to look like? And I think for many people in my generation, that is what we live. You know, we do try to find jobs that feel meaningful to us. Millennials spend more money on experiences than things, and that's part of that is probably that we can't afford a house, but we can afford, you know, a weekend away. But we do invest more of our money in, you know, things that are experiential and pleasurable rather than material. You know, it's not that I think my parents don't hold those values. It's more that I think boomers were very much funneled towards stability. And millennials have tried to build lives that, because I think that stability isn't really on offer for us, can at least reflect our values in other ways.
Well, Jill, thank you for that, because honestly, that must be the reason that I often think I'm a bit askew from my generation, because I was able to, with my parents' encouragement, and I kind of followed in my father's footsteps in broadcasting, but I was able to do that. I never worked a day of my life where I wasn't doing something that I loved, felt good about, and passionate about, and I didn't spend it in a cubicle just trying to make money for money's sake. Money was a byproduct of something that I loved to do. So that might explain perhaps my different way of thinking about some of these things and why I'm more in sync with the millennials. Explain to us, when we use terms like cancel culture about you or safe spaces that you have to have, and maybe that's even a younger generation than the millennials, I mean, what are we trying to say about who? Is that, again, getting back to the snowflake concept?
It absolutely is. I mean, look, I think, of course, it is crucial and important to point out and criticize encroachments on free speech and expression wherever you see them. But the conversations around cancel culture and safe spaces really have morphed, you know, into this generational shaming and into kind of liberal shaming, you know, this idea that calling something racist or sexist is canceling it. When in reality, you know, the biggest purveyors of cancel culture are conservatives. You don't see a lot of progressives on Fox News. You know, when it comes to campus culture, conservative religious institutions formally bar, for example, pro-choice organizations or LGBT organizations from forming. You know, I think that some context and some perspective is necessary. You know, I think the fact that millennials are adding more to the conversation or complicating the conversation or challenging long-held beliefs is certainly not the same thing as canceling anyone.
You also talk about the boomer anxiety industrial complex. Explain that.
So this is something that is very much pushed, you know, again, by right-wing media to make boomers feel like they are under attack, and particularly, I think, conservative boomers, but it's targeted at everyone. You know, this idea that they were a generation that did tons of great things, and now their values, their way of life is under attack, and it's under attack by these young, you know, millennials, which they sort of use as a broad term for anybody under the age of 40, you know, which gives way to these absolutely absurd, you know, Fox News headlines on right-wing sites like, you know, Breitbart.com, all of which are about, you know, simultaneously that millennials are weak, stupid, useless, and overly sensitive, but also profoundly dangerous. And the point is to froth up, you know, boomer fear and boomer outrage over a changing world and funnel that into the conservative political project.
You know, when I read the headline, millennials and younger are now the new majority, I'm wondering where your allies are in this. I mean, you're the new majority. And we're talking about Gen Xers who were born in the late 60s and 70s. We're talking about members of the Generation Z. They were born after 1996. To define your generation, you can certainly give us the date that you think. There's just a little bit of wiggle room, I know, on that. But how difficult is this transition going to be? Because you now are the majority. We baby boomers are dying daily at a pretty good clip, and the coronavirus is not helping. So the question is, how is this transition to making this your world going to occur?
You know, it's a really important question and is certainly for me a great source of frustration. I mean, obviously, the transition demographically is going to occur because it has to. I think where we've really kind of dropped the ball on this one is that, you know, like I said, the oldest millennials are turning 40 this year. And yet, there is not a single millennial in the U.S. Senate. 80 out of 100 senators are over the age of 55. Zero are under the age of 40. That wasn't true when boomers were young. So there are several baby boomer senators who took their seats when they were in their 30s. There are at least a few Gen Xers who took their seats when they were
in their
30s.
Well, one of them was Joe Biden, who I think came into the Senate when he was, I don't know, 29?
He was 30. And Joe Biden, Joe Biden actually is going to be the first president since the 90s who is not a baby boomer because he's a silent. He's older. there certainly was, for your generation and very much for the generations before, an easier path to power for the young. And millennials have been almost universally shut out of political power. So in the 2018 midterms, it was a big story that millennials, you know, had finally taken up their sort of rightful place in Congress. And the House of Representatives had gone from 1% millennial to 6%. It's not nothing, but, you know, it's not exactly storming the gates. And, you know, until we get more millennials into positions of power and, you know, eventually Gen Zers as well, we're just not going to see the prioritization of issues that affect us most. You know, you take climate change, for example. About half of baby boomers don't even believe that climate change is caused by human behavior. It's not true of millennials. Millennials overwhelmingly recognize that human beings and, you know, what we do in the world causes the climate to change in ways that are terrible for the future of humanity. And so if we have political representatives who don't even believe that the sort of burning, flooding future world that millennials are set to inherit is a thing, we're never going to have action. And, you know, when you look at the political views of millennials, they really do line up with our representatives, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, who's been a great fighter for issues like climate change and healthcare in Congress, but has very much been stymied. And other young politicians or would-be politicians like her have not received the same hand up and the same support from our political institutions as baby boomers did when they were young and ambitious. And unfortunately, many of the baby boomers who have been in office for a very long time don't really seem interested in sharing power and certainly uninterested in handing over the reins.
Or they're much more interested in gradualism, but your generation is saying, look, we're not youngsters anymore. We are now the majority, and yet we're so far behind where you were at the same stage of your life that some of the changes that we need to make in daycare provision, if we wonder why you're not having the children at the ages we did, and we have to look at the cost of that. We have to look at the fact that women are really excelling in many sectors of our society, and yet they're still expected to do so many things. And I think during the pandemic, we're seeing that they're teachers and homeschoolers, and they're also trying to get on with their careers. So there is so much going on all at the same time. So those are issues, whether it be climate change, daycare, healthcare, that you don't want gradual change. That's why some of these systemic changes that people talk about that may scare my generation don't scare you at all.
Absolutely, because we look around and we realize this is an emergency. You know, the fact also that millennials grew up in a newly connected world with the internet has meant that, unlike, you know, really any previous generation, it's incredibly easy for us to look and see, well, how do other countries manage this? What do our peer groups look like in Sweden, in France, in the UK, you know, in China? And having that connective power of the internet, I think, really allows us to see just how badly the U.S. has failed its young people. You know, when boomers want incremental change and, you know, we look over at Sweden and we say, well, you know, folks, parents there get, you know, a shared year of parental leave and men are pushed to take it. And then there's universal childcare so parents can go back to work and there are robust worker protections so you can't lose your job for getting pregnant, which is unfortunately not totally the case in the United States. It certainly makes it seem not just like an emergency, which it is, but also we've seen this done. We can look at the possibilities right in front of our face. And so the idea that we need to be incremental and slow in these changes, it just, I think it strikes a lot of millennials as totally absurd when we're so easily able to look at all of the rest of our economic peer nations and see that they've done this with great success.
Let me go to the conclusion of your book and some things that you write that you can expand upon. You say, in so many ways, millennials are boomers' cultural heirs, carrying forward a commitment to individuality, pleasure, and purpose. Many boomers were the foot soldiers in the movements that demanded America to be a better version of itself. And like us, boomers spent their young adulthood being derided and chided for being different, and therefore narcissistic and wrong. Yes, millennials could do more to foster intergenerational understanding and to be less reactive and more nuanced in how we approach our baby boomer elders. But boomers, we really need you to do your part. And that means we need you to consider what the world looks like to us and what kind of world you want to leave us with. I think that's such an important concept because oftentimes when we think about our various guideposts, my guideposts were the 60s and were the generational change that was going on there. And JFK saying, I'll take it from here, Eisenhower. I've got a new generation that wants to follow me into the future. So that was a guidepost for me, as was the Cold War and a whole range of things. Your guideposts are just so different, and I don't think a lot of us boomers really understand that.
I think that's right. And as I said in the book, that question of what world are you leaving? I think a lot of boomers will go back and they say, well, you know, I marched in the 60s and I did that. Well, that was 60 years ago. you know, what has been done politically on a very broad social level to leave a ladder up for your kids and for their kids? And I think, unfortunately, a clear-eyed assessment of what's been done shows that instead of leaving that ladder, many boomers have torn the rungs off. And millennials are now looking forward to a future that, you know, does not look particularly bright. And we don't necessarily see the necessary changes happening that would make the future better for Gen Zers and for millennials' kids. So it's not that I want boomers to feel, you know, ashamed or to go off and die in a corner. It's more that I think an honest reckoning of how we got here, even among the boomers who did not vote for people like Ronald Reagan, is beyond overdue and incredibly necessary to figure out how we get out of this. And then I would really like baby boomers to assess what can we do now, not just to make things better for young folks, but also to share in power, to share in our resources, and not just with our own kids, but with society as a whole.
You reminded us, because this book is very current, that the protests of 2020 reflect a generational as well as a racial neglect. And I know you did hint at that earlier, but I think that's a really important point to punctuate.
Absolutely. I mean, just you know, looking at who was out protesting all summer long was overwhelmingly folks under the age of 40. So it was millennials and Gen Zers. And one of the things that I think has been incredibly powerful about the Black Lives Matter movement is that, yes, there is kind of one primary demand, which is stop the police killing of African Americans, right? But the movement is so incredibly savvy and deep. And when you look at the Black Lives Matter website and you look at the demands that the movement is making, you know, it's addressing things like move money from policing into investments in education and health. I think it's a recognition of all the ways in which generational neglect has also been animated by profound racial neglect and what a malignant force that has been for today's young people.
Jill Filipovic, I can't thank you enough. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm rooting for the millennials. And, you know, at one point on one of my podcasts, I suggested, I know a lot of people talk about the voting age and should we lower it to 16? And I threw out a concept that maybe we should start excluding those of us of a certain age because we're not going to be here to have to deal with the problems that we're really trying to address through governmental and social policy. So maybe you cut off our ability because we vote. We do vote, as you say, for our own benefits, for Social Security and Medicare, and we're pretty dogged about it. So maybe we should be looking at the upper end rather than the lower end and extending that because you're the ones inheriting whatever it is that we as decision makers still are deciding. I want to thank you again, Jill, for being with me on America Trends.
Thanks so much for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.